From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The notion of tragedy, in its modern connotations, is altogether different from its meanings in the ancient world of Greek drama. Yet the connections between ancient and modern notions of the tragic persist. What are these notions? How do they diverge from and parallel one another? Soundings put those questions to a group of scholars at the National Humanities Center, and now presents the first in a series of discussions on notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists are Peter Smith, Robert Terhorst, Peter Burian, and Eugene Falk. Peter Smith teaches classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Terhorst is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, on leave from the University of Arizona. At the center, he's writing a book entitled The Fortunes of the Novel, in which he examines the novel as a literary form whose development stems from its artistic and economic focus on money. Peter Burian teaches in the Department of Classics at Duke University. Eugene Falk recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where his research addressed the difference between specific patterns of tragedy in France and Germany and the universal and changeless concept of the tragic. Here is Peter Smith.
Wayne, I suspect that our popular use of tragedy, or when we call something tragic, now has more consistency than any use in the ancient world, because the adjective in Greek, tragic, is very seldom used in talking about these plays, and it's not singled out as a quality which plays put on in the Festival of Dionysus were obliged to have or were expected to have. The only comment on that line I can think of immediately is Aristotle's remark that Euripides is in some way the most tragic of the tragedians. He is tragikotatos. But the term is so seldom used in Greek literary criticism that it has proven difficult even for us to be sure just what Aristotle meant. Mm-hmm. The word was applied to plays put on at the annual festival in Athens of Dionysus, and not really used to describe a type of action. And I think that now when we say that a death is tragic or an event that surprises us and brings unhappiness to someone is tragic, we're really using it with greater consistency. I want to defer to Peter Burian on this, mm-hmm. as well. We're looking at each other to see if either of us can think of much use of the term tragic, either applied to the theater or to everyday life.
Applied to everyday life, I should think we could say more or less categorically no. Tragedy is a kind of, describes, it's the name of a certain kind of performance that occurred in certain circumstances and had certain specific formal constraints about it, which were unlike those of other kinds of performances. It would be as if hundreds of years later the term musical comic had become a term describing a certain way of being in the world.
I see.
And people could argue whether something was really musically comic or not. A lot of our discussions about tragedy as a literary genre, I think, are influenced by what we want to think the tragic is, which is some sort of extrapolation. The Greeks would have found it very easy to tell you what tragedy was. They would say, go to the great Dionysia, and you know, between 9 and 3 in the afternoon, those are going to be the tragedies. It's perhaps, at least from our point of view, starting with Aristotle and the Poetics, that an attempt is made to define tragedy in some way that would permit you to talk about degrees of tragicness, initially for Aristotle in the literary works, mm-hmm. but because of the terms he uses, for example, terms that involve justification, terms that involve the arousal of certain kinds of emotions in people, the term begins to have applicability to life outside the theater.
I want to hear what you have to say about how Aristotle bears on notions of tragedy then and now, but just parenthetically, what was Dionysus? What was the role? Is that a god, a man, a figure? What? How does that enter into this discussion?
Well, Dionysus was not just the Athenian, but the general Greek divinity who was felt to be indwelling in nature generally. He was not at all in the ancient world, the cheerful Bacchus holding a bunch of grapes and what we think of in modern painting, or almost modern painting, but was a very serious divinity indeed, who in myth often overcame opponents, human opponents of his worship, by driving them mad or by driving other people mad in such a way that they would attack and kill his opponents. And the force represented by the god, which was generally beneficent, could be turned against those and would be turned against those who denied it and who opposed it.
And that would lead to tragic circumstances.
What we would call tragic circumstances,
the downfall of an individual, yeah, is that
but,
right?
But it's remarkable that very few of the plays written in Athens in the 5th century, in the great age of tragedy, concern Dionysus. A number do, but there's clearly no limitation in the Athenian theater to the myths concerned with Dionysus. When I think of Dionysus trying to define what he as a divinity stands for, I think of a wonderful line of Dylan Thomas, not speaking of Dionysus, but speaking, I think, of the force that Greeks felt to be that god. He referred to the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. The implications of natural, undeniable fruitfulness, of beauty, and also of potential destructiveness, of a force that cannot be contained and can explode in nature and in people too, was something that Greeks were fascinated with and determined to deal with. Their gods were not given the job of saving us, but rather, I think, the job of somehow explaining, ultimately, the world in which we live. So they're responsible for the bad as well as the good.
Let's come back to Aristotle. I take it that he is, what, the first theoretician of tragedy. Peter Burian, is that right?
Critical discussion of tragedy begins with Aristotle and begins as part of a much larger project of classifying the genres of literature and their particular excellences, which seems to have really started in a way as an answer to Plato's famous attack on poetry in the Republic and elsewhere. Seems to be designed to say, no, there is a real human value and a real truth value in literary works of arts, and we can understand it by approaching them from this point of view. What we have, Aristotle's Poetics, is a rather fragmentary treatise, probably in large part from lecture notes, not a finished work, that represents only one facet of his interest in literature. But since it's the earliest monument of literary criticism and stands alone in a way for its antiquity and its analytical power, it's had a tremendous influence.
Well, what did he say? Most people, I think, know that Aristotle said that plays should have beginnings and middles and ends. What did he have to say about tragedy? Bob Terhorst?
Well, I was amused because you said should have, and I think one area we question Aristotle on is, after all, he comes after the fact, the great age is over. So is Aristotle describing or prescribing? I defer to the classicists here, but my feeling is that in his own area, in the realm of Greek art, he is describing. But when Aristotle came back to us in the Renaissance, especially his Italian interpreters looked upon him as prescriptive. So we have at least two Aristotles here, one who's looking at the great body of Greek drama, and then his later interpreters who establish him as an authority and say what Aristotle set out we should do.
Oedipus the King was Aristotle's favorite play, clearly, as well, at least his favorite example, to illustrate in the Poetics a number of things which he recommends as characteristic of the best kind of play.
How old is this play? What if you had to nail down a time in history that it occurred, when would it
sometime
be?
Shortly after 430 BC, during the early years of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. We don't know exactly the year, but within 4 or 5 years, and a couple of generations before Aristotle sat down to write about tragedy and found in Oedipus the King an example which he thought better than most any other of the procedures he thought should be followed by an author who wanted to write a good tragic play. And particularly, he recommends that every tragedy should have a recognition, an agnorisis, a disclosure of some truth that had not been known before. And also, each tragedy must have a change of fortune, a radical change of fortune, either from happiness to unhappiness, or, interestingly, the other way around. And he says the best kind of play is one in which those two will coincide, in which the recognition of a truth one had not known coincides with or causes or even is the change of fortune from happiness to unhappiness. But it's a case of parallelism, I think, not of the play illustrating something that an audience is meant to take home as a piece of learning, as one might from a lecture.
May I jump in at this point? I should perhaps say parenthetically that whenever, as a parent, I sort of despair that schools really can teach our children anything, I think of my experience as a teacher and discover that everyone who comes into my literature classes knows, as a matter of certain truth, that the way the Greeks did this was that they took a reasonably good person who had a terrible tragic flaw and showed him destroyed for it, and that this is what Greek tragedy is and means. And I have to spend a great deal of energy as a teacher trying to disabuse them of this notion, which I suppose can be drawn back to Aristotle and to a good degree over those Italian Renaissance critics that Bob Terhorst mentioned a moment ago, but simply won't do as a way of explaining the experience of Greek tragedy, or so it seems to me. The case of Oedipus is very interesting. We have, on the one hand, this hunt for his tragic flaw, what Aristotle calls the hamartia, a word in itself whose meaning is very uncertain, might range from simply an intellectual failing, a failure of understanding, to some deep-seated moral, some kind of sin within the soul of Oedipus, let's say. No one quite knows what it means, but people who read the play in this key watch him get mad at Tiresias, watch him jump to the conclusion that Creon is in league with Tiresias against him, see him speak abusively to those who tell him things that he doesn't want to know, and jump to the conclusion that this is, in a sense, a deeply flawed man. He has a nasty temper, and that the gods are somehow punishing him for this fault. This does not, it seems to me, describe a deep message or a deeply moving kind of drama at all. Whatever we feel in Oedipus must happen at some remove from that kind of formulation. The other possibility is to take Oedipus as, in a certain way, morally neutral, and suppose that what the play shows us is simply the workings of fate, that is, that we are somehow puppets being dangled on a string. It doesn't matter what sort of man Oedipus is precisely, or even what he does. This is his fate, and he's going to be made to suffer for it so that we can learn how powerful the gods are and how little real power and real worth we have. Seems to me also an entirely unacceptable reading of Sophocles.
Gene?
I'm struck by the fact, as everybody else is, that at the end of the play, we find that Oedipus has blinded himself. But actually, he is blind to begin with, because what the unfolding of this play shows is a gradual recognition of his ignorance, and how he deals with that ignorance. His pursuit of an insight which he did not have, and his destiny is really prescribed by the lack of insight with which the play starts. That's a very important point, I think, not only in Oedipus, but actually in every tragedy. There is always the element of ignorance, of our inability to foresee. But the insight doesn't occur only in the audience. The insight occurs on stage, in the characters. And this is one of the features which I believe we may find in any play that deserves the name, which has now been has become traditional, of tragedy.
In Greek comedy, very often a main character or the main character does not know who or she is. Very often it's a question of a foundling, which is precisely the situation we have in Oedipus. So just from a technical point of view, Oedipus is very much up against it because he doesn't know who he is. I would be tempted to have a bad temper myself if I were operating on one set of assumptions and this set of assumptions was being progressively undermined. So one way in which this tragedy, at least technically, operates on ground that is very close to comedy, later comedy now, of course, I'm speaking of, but is precisely this not knowing who one is. And if we talk about ignorance in Oedipus, and I think it's a big problem in a lot of dramatic literature, people, in order to act wisely, decently, need to know who they are. One of the great processes in Oedipus is finding out who one is. It's a great process in a great Spanish play called Life is a Dream, in which the main character thinks he knows who he is, but he doesn't. So that just from a technical point of view, I think knowing really who one is an awfully useful item of knowledge for a figure in the drama.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first segment in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature, from the Greek dramas of Sophocles to the modern plays of Eugene O'Neill. The panelists are Peter Smith, Robert Terhorst, Peter Burian, and Eugene Falk. Peter Burian is a professor of classics at Duke University. Robert Terhorst is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of Spanish at the University of Arizona. Peter Smith and Eugene Falk teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Peter Smith in the Department of Classics, Eugene Falk in the Department of Comparative Literature. Eugene Falk recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Here is Peter Burian.
Could I just add to what Bob Terhorst has been saying, that this joining of comedy and tragedy is very useful, I think, from another point of view, because the recognition, the anagnorisis as insight, tells us something about the world that links comedy and tragedy. This speaks to a traditional question in the theory of tragedy, which can simply be formulated, why should all this human suffering give us pleasure? And one answer is, what links the kind of comedy that Bob Terhorst was speaking of to tragedy, that is the discovery that the world has pattern, has meaning. This seems to me to be fundamental. It's why, for example, in Greek tragedy, the moment of discovery may be at once a moment of horror and of joy, both for the discoverers and for us. In another play of Sophocles, the Trachinians, the women of Trachis, when Heracles, who has been poisoned by a robe that his wife has given him as a gesture of love, but which has a curse on it, which is now killing him in the most painful possible way. And at the end, when he's just about to die, and he's the pieces are put together for him, and he finally figures out what has happened. He says in the words of the remarkable translation of Ezra Pound, splendor, it all coheres. And it's the sense, splendor, it all coheres. In a sense, when the foundling turns out to be the royal child and comes home to take up his inheritance, which is also the story of Oedipus, only his inheritance is a blighted one, he's saying the world doesn't operate at random. It doesn't have a kind of disorder in which we simply grope blindly. There is something to be seen. What we see may initially be horror, but behind that horror is a law, a lawfulness, an understandability, which permits, finally, a truly human existence, which permits us to fulfill our potential as human beings. And this is, while it can be immediately full of the pity and fear that Aristotle speaks of, also something quite exalting. And I think it accounts for a lot of the importance that tragedy has had for Western culture since the beginning.
Peter and Bob, I'm not sure whether I'm disagreeing with you, but maybe I'm just appending a point, but I'd call attention to the tremendous difference between what is discovered in a 5th century Athenian tragedy and what is discovered in a 4th or 3rd century comedy later, because in both cases it's true one's identity, a character's identity, may suddenly be revealed to another or to himself. But in the latter case, the comic case, it's often true, normally true, that identity is a happy discovery. Someone who had been thought to be a slave turns out to be a freeborn Athenian and therefore able to marry his or her lover. The discovery is a healing force and almost always allows a marriage or a family reunion, which had been in some way threatened, among other things, threatened by human misunderstandings and displacements. One gets a sense in comedy of the 4th and later centuries that the pattern of things which we normally are unaware of and which we stumble about in our lives in ignorance of is in some sense ultimately a beneficent one. Many characters in comedy are brought to a happy good fortune in spite of their faults, in spite of their suspicions of one another, their miserliness, their greed, their foolishness, their naivete. Whereas in the tragedy of a century and more earlier, from which comedy imitated this notion of recognition, suddenly disclosed identity, what tends to be discovered is that the pattern behind things, if there is one, which we normally live in ignorance of, is a profoundly unbeneficent one. One which we would not have chosen, which brings us nothing but unhappiness, as it does to Oedipus. It's true that knowledge of that fact, discovery of that fact, can be ennobling, but there's a polar difference, I think, in the way a tragic hero comes to see the hidden forces which have been determining his life and the way a comic character comes to discover the forces affecting his life. In the 5th century, Athenians seem not to have assumed that the gods were looking out for them in any way.
And here we perhaps go back to the question that Bob Terhorst raised of whether a definition of tragedy is going to be simply descriptive or prescriptive. When Oedipus is an interesting example from this point of view, too, because he's not destroyed. As Knox has shown, the play suggests a whole series of equations. Oedipus is a god. Well, no, we find out pretty soon that he's not that. Oedipus is nothing. We find out at the end that he's not that either. When the chorus says to Oedipus, in effect, why did you strike out your eyes? Why didn't you just kill yourself? He says, anybody to whom this has happened must be singled out for some strange and remarkable destiny. What he learns is, of course, horror and is suffering, but it's also more than that. It is signed somehow with the signature of this of the cosmos, of this ordered reality. And I think that beneficent or maleficent work in that sort of discourse, a little bit like good and bad in Aristotle's description of character, as a, in a way sidetracking us from more central, perhaps metaphysical issues.
I'm glad that Peter Burian is pointing to the relation between ignorance and discovery, and the discovery being the discovery of an order that exists out there, and in relation to which we learn to identify ourselves. That point of the ignorance, and not only of Oedipus, but really of any tragic character, forces the character to a confrontation not only with the forces outside, but at the same time with himself. It leads to a self, to the hero's self-definition. And that leads me to the next point. We are what we are by virtue of the way we confront the problem of our being, but that problem is always tied, implicitly or explicitly, to an order out there. The minute we ignore that order, the minute we deny that order, the minute we assume that life is absurd, a fairly recent term, we really destroy the preconditions for a tragedy.
Bob Terhorst?
Well, I don't want to cavil, but I find that set of terms very nicely applicable to comedy itself. It seems to me that in a great many plays, the self is a riddle. And once one begins to have some knowledge, some answer to the riddle of the self, one can adjust the self to society, and this would be the more usual comic way of doing the thing. But once you do get some notion of the self, then you can come to terms with the social order and what you would probably call the cosmic order. Except here. It may be a question of level, and Aristotle himself was very, very much interested in level, and level has a lot to do with the way he sets tragedy up. But schematically, I don't think these events are incommensurable.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this has been the first in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. The panelists were Peter Smith and Eugene Falk of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, and Peter Burian of Duke University. Professors Falk and Terhorst are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.